This is episode number 7. You should never regret anything in life. If it's good, it's wonderful. If it's bad, it's just an experience.
Welcome to the Innovateology podcast, where it is all about unleashing the creative side to find those brilliant, disruptive ideas to validate and build innovative solutions to solve life's problems.
Hello and welcome back to episode number 7. This is your host, Mary, and today we're going to be discussing the continuation of episode number 6, which is questions, as I call the life hacks, or discovering those life efficiencies. And we have on the line also Linda and Melissa, who are going to be joining us again. And these are a series of questions that I just came up with, and it kind of dives deep into some of the efficiencies that we've gained in life. And I have a little disclaimer. So they're subjective, and in no way was there any double-blind studies done. This is just one person's point of view, and it should be taken as you see fit and applied as you see fit in your life. So with that, let's go right into these questions. We have 5 more to get into.
So question number 6 is, how do you save money? So Linda, let's start with you.
Yeah, well, for me, actually, money thing has largely been, you know, recognizing what I don't need to spend money on. You know, we have a lot of costs of living that are fixed, but they shift as your lifestyle changes. So, for instance, in corporate life, I used to have a huge dry cleaning bill. I used to actually even have significant salon expenses because I would go for the weekly manicures and monthly pedicures and the massages to relieve tension and all those good things. And so what I came to realize is that there's a lot of expenses that I had before that really get trimmed away. And actually what's nice about that is it aligns with Melissa in terms of just saying, okay, now my wardrobe has shifted too. And, you know, I can simplify my, you know, what I wear and kind of really empty a lot of the clothes that I used to have to worry about keeping clean and intact. And just really being, I've been actually shocked about, you know, how many expenses there really are that I formerly had that I don't have now. So some of the money managing now has been more just recognizing the shift in my spending. And also it just seems that the awareness of, you know, where how my values have shifted over time has also helped me to feel I don't need as much as I used to need. So that's how I've been addressing money management lately.
So Melissa, how do you save money? I know you mentioned about minimizing your clothes, but how do you save money?
Right. Well, mine's real short and sweet. I actually don't spend any money. You know what I mean? Like, I'm just like cut out spending, except, you know, right now on healthy food is definitely, you know, I'll spend, and I need health insurance, obviously, and, you know, keeping my house a little up, but that's it. Like, and that's more because I've focused on my parents rather than, you know, myself. But it's really kept my money, you know, saved money. So what about you, Mary?
So I know I'm at a different stage of life. And I know sometimes throughout phases where we need to save money. And I think when you're first starting out, especially when you're getting a house, how do you feel that interior? I know that a lot of people just run to IKEA. And no offense to IKEA, I think it's a great store. But you end up spending more time putting the stuff together. So what I found, and this is that dilemma of time, is estatesales.net. So you already have that furniture that's built up, and it's usually better quality than most stuff that's out there, that you can get a lot of great deals on estatesales.net and also Craigslist and some deals. I think whenever people come into my house, they think, wow, how'd you get all this furniture? And then they kind of look at me like, you know, I don't expect this. And I tell them about all the great finds I found and the prices. So for example, I had got a baby grand piano for $200, practically brand new. And people always ask that story, which is another podcast in itself of, going into estate sales and negotiating, which is probably another podcast as negotiating. So the second part is kids stuff. So kids stuff costs a lot of money and it doesn't need to be brand new. what I found is that there are tons of pop-up consignment sales and garage sales. And I've pretty much gotten all of my kids' stuff for under $500, from clothes for the first 5 years to high chairs to everything, which I think on average, and I was just looking at this the other day, for the first year, if you were to buy everything brand new, it's about $10,000 to bring that, wow, that, all that baby stuff home. So really from $500 to $10,000, that's a huge savings right there. Some examples of, some pop-up consignment sales, a really great one is Just Between Friends. They have them twice a year, once in the fall, once in the spring, and you can get pretty much a whole new wardrobe. And my favorite day to go is the last day of their sale because everything is 50% off. So I pretty much just walk in there with a shopping cart and just start loading up for, toddler clothes at this point now. Another great one is swap.com, and I'll put that in the show notes. So if you're driving, don't worry, it's in the show notes. Swap.com is great because you can actually send in your old clothes. So Melissa, if you're looking to clear out your closet, you can actually send your clothes in and they take like 50% off because they post everything for you. You set the prices. So what's nice about that is that you get money back for anything that you're not using. And then what I do is I put that right back into swap.com and I actually get clothes for myself, kids, other people in my family who maybe just want to switch up a little bit. So that's number two. Number three is saving on agency fees for nannies. So I hire my own. While I'm still perfecting this process, and I'm sure this will be probably a future podcast episode as well, what I found is that by hiring a nanny directly, you can actually seek out some of the best candidates out there yourself, and you're also saving on that agency fee. The next part is groceries. That's a huge expense for any family. I think the average that groceries that people spend when they're trying to get organic and high quality is about, and this is for a family of five, they said the average is about $1,200. So what I've done is I've tried to get my food bill under $700, and this is for four people, and they're athletes, they eat a lot, and so what a grocery store that I found is Aldi's, and this is actually like, I've heard it's like part of the Trader Joe's family. What they do is they sell unbranded products, and it's probably the same stuff that you'll see on the shelves at Trader Joe's that's branded, but they have it for pretty much half the price that we'll find at other grocery stores. So I'm sure whenever I go to Aldi's, my twice a month grocery run, everybody looks at me like I'm crazy because I go in there with two shopping carts and I fill it full based on the products that I need. So as I'm going through the line, no one wants to get behind me because you have to actually bag your own groceries there. So that's how they also save money, is that you have to bag your own groceries. So it's a little bit different and you have to pay for your own shopping cart. So it's like 25 cents. So they, you know, it's a little bit different way of shopping, but they have them all over Europe. And I'm glad that they have them here in the U.S. because it's been great to get organic products for half the price than what you'll get at other stores. Another great tip that I have is travel insurance. So I have a very active family, and myself, I'm very active, and I can't tell you how many times I've been traveling and I've either tripped down the stairs myself and sprained my ankle and not know it's broken and had to go to the hospital. And when you're out of network or you're traveling from another country, you don't understand like all the medical bills that are there. It's probably some of the best investment. I think traveling even this time around, I'm actually in Seattle right now, and I just had to run one of my children to the emergency room because we were at the zoo and he fell down and cut his lip. Everything's okay. It's just one of these stories that you have to deal with when you're a parent. And thank goodness for travel insurance, because I have no worries about walking into any type of medical facility and getting care and not having to worry if it's in network, out of network. We know everything will be taken care of. So those are just a few ways that I save money. I'm sure both Linda and Melissa can relate to saving money is a huge part of helping go a long way. So let's go into question number seven, and this is something that we touched on in podcast number two around some eating habits that we all have within our family, but what is considered healthy eating in your family? So Linda, why don't we start with you?
Sure. Well, over recent years, my diet's become, you know, increasingly more the fruits and the vegetables, with actually less and less of the meats, and it's not, you know, for any aversion or philosophy around issues with meat. It's just that we wanted to increase the amount of vegetables we eat. So that's part of it. We also have cut out keeping any kind of snacky stuff that could be unhealthy in our house. And the other thing is that since I've been doing the mindfulness practice that I've alluded to, I've also had a couple of insights around my bad eating habits. And one was that I realized that sometimes I'm not at all hungry, but I just kind of long for a certain taste and texture in the snacks that I particularly like. And a friend of mine helped me to appreciate one great alternative because I like things with crunch and just light salt. And so what she suggested was raw string beans. And granted, that's not going to appeal to everybody, but when I visited with her and we chatted and snacked on the raw, lightly salted string beans, it was just delicious and totally was satisfied my you know, my snack needs. So that's just how I have been continuing to work on the healthy eating.
And Melissa, how about you?
Well, I try to do it as a mental paradigm shift, basically saying, you know, now that I have prediabetes, I say to myself, what, you know, because your stomach and your brain says, ooh, I want that. But I now am not trying to be emotionally eating and more say what's good for my body. So it's a shift from I can't have that to I don't want that anymore. So, you know, I'm on maybe, you know, there's probably 10% of people out there listening who have diabetes or the 30% additional who don't know they have prediabetes. But, you know, I've gone into more of a low carb meals, which then I sat down and figured out, okay, how many, you know, for each meal I made for 2 weeks, that it's all under 20 carbs per meal. Now, you can subtract your fiber from that. So mostly I'm eating a lot of vegetables, very little fruit except for the berries. And then unlike Linda, you know, I need, you know, protein I add into each meal, which is some eggs, either meat or some fish. And so, you know, snacking is a hard time because my blood sugar does drop, so I have to have my snacks prepared. So I make my own low-carb snacks. So I have crackers are too high in carbs, so I use I make my own crispy crackers from almond and coconut flour with cheese. I make my own chocolate pudding with avocado, sour cream, and chocolate. I make my own baked taco shells with green squash and cheese. And then I actually make my own low-carb cereal, which I bake, and it has basically nuts, cinnamon, whey protein powder, almond flour, and vanilla. So that's how I do it. How about you, Mary?
Wow.
So it sounds like we need to do a podcast on
everything
that Melissa eats. So that might be a recipe or maybe even a video, if we can get there, a YouTube channel for pre-diabetic cooking. So some ways that I try and eat healthy. Well, first of all, with kids, they're pretty much eating every 2 hours, 2 to 3 hours. And so actually there's been some research done that, you know, when we're brought onto this earth, we actually eat about every 2 to 3 hours, about kind of keeping your energy levels up and eating more frequently. So it doesn't mean that you're eating lots of food all the time, but you're actually just kind of eating like a cup of nuts every 2 hours, or eating a smaller lunch and more snacks frequently. So that's something that I've tried to take on so I can have a lot more energy. And also when you do have kids and you're trying to eat breakfast and run out the door, you really don't have time to cook up eggs and bacon and the whole nine yards. So it's usually just a bowl of granola and then I run out the door and then eat, you know, a little bit later some nuts and dried fruit. So some ways that I've tried to do this and also eliminate sugar, because I sometimes feel like the cereals in the morning have way too much sugar in them, is trying to make healthy foods. So I make all my own granola and use like coconut oil or a little bit of agave and some honey. And I've actually calculated that that saves about an average of $30 a month, since we were on the money-saving topic as well, too. Then I'll make my own baby food. And normally baby food costs about $1.50 for every 4 ounces. And if you have very hungry kids, you'll go through about 4 packets every single meal. So I make all my own baby food. There's some great ways to mix up different baby foods if you know, this is a first time thing for you. It's on momtastic.com, and I'll put the link there in the show notes. And what's really interesting is I actually got to meet a doctor who put together a plan of her own baby food. And what she found was is that here in the States, we kind of have bland baby food. So kids just tend to like bland macaroni and cheese. Like if you go to a restaurant, there tends to be a menu full of kids meals. Well, my kids actually eat what I eat. And it actually is, they're still doing science on this. So I don't have all the notes in front of me. But one thing that she found was is that in cultures around the world, that babies actually eat what the parents eat. So, you know, if it's in India, they'll eat some tikka masala. So what I started doing is I'll start putting spice into the baby's food. So putting like a little bit of cinnamon with apples, or a little bit of pumpkin with apples, with a little bit of, so it's like a pumpkin pie. So I started doing this, and I also made ratatouille. And I ground it all up, and that became one of the staples, because everybody came over and they actually liked the way the baby food tasted, that we could make our own sauces from it. I actually make another fun one was, people always ask me, how do you get your kids to eat broccoli? And for my toddler, I have broccoli bites, which is broccoli with cheese and breadcrumbs. And for getting them started, I make cream of broccoli soup. So it's just chicken broth, broccoli, some mushrooms, and you grind it all up, and it actually tastes really good. Like, I would want to eat it. Another way is during the week, setting your menu. So, you know, how can you look at the footprint that you bring on the world? So Monday, I do Meatless Monday. So everything that we do is meatless. We don't use any type of meat whatsoever. And then we usually have the leftovers for Tuesday. And then it's chicken or fish rotating each week on Wednesdays. And then Fridays is usually whatever we have leftover, or, you know, throwing in some red meat. So it kind of controls my buying habits, making sure that, you know, we're evenly dispersing that way that we have. And then by doing that Meatless Monday, we're being conscious on meat production and, you know, making sure that we're not buying more than we should, or, you know, eating more than we should in that particular area. So that's question number 7. So let's move on to question number 8. So question number 8 is, and this is a good one, I think a lot of people get stumped when I ask this question, but what is the best criteria to measure success? So, Linda, why don't we start with you?
Well, I think one important criteria for measuring success is making sure that you're defining success for you, because it's so, so easy to get caught up in actually peer pressures and just kind of societal expectations. And I have a quick example to share, which is a couple of my single friends who had bought these, you know, large homes, and years later said, you know, I really don't know why I purchased it, because it's just me. I don't need all this, you know, I don't need 3,000 square feet for one person. And, you know, one of them just said it was actually because it was a sign for them to kind of feel they had reached a certain point of success and that they could. Which is great. But for another friend, it was more or less because all the other friends were doing it. So I think, you know, we all fall into those traps where we kind of think markers of success maybe are things that others set up and perhaps aren't really what we set up for ourselves. So for me, the main point of the criteria for success is to be true to my vision, my plan, my values, and to really do self-checks to make sure that when the way I'm living is really in alignment with the way I want to live.
And Melissa, how about you? What is the best criteria to measure success?
Well, I think success is something that you earned, so you strove for it. So it's something that, you know, you had to stretch yourself for. But it should not be the result, because if you just focus on the result of your success, then, you know, it, you can be unhappy with it. You can be, you know what I mean? You're then it's too much judgment. I think it's better to just look at the process. You know, were you successful at the process? And, you know, that you should realize that there is going to be struggle. And people think struggle is negative, but I think you have to switch your head and say your thinking and your mindset that, you know, struggle is part of it. That's part of growing, and it's actually a good thing.
I'd say welcome to life. You're going to struggle. So it's a struggle for mom that first time that the baby's born. So, and then I say welcome to life. If you're not ready for it, then we got some talking to do. We got to change that mindset around. So for me, what is the best criteria to measure success? I say it's long-term happiness. So not just looking for that quick win today, but what does that long-term happiness look like? So setting those long-term goals with the ability to evolve them and to truly find clarity. So I almost think of life as like a crystal ball where you can't always see what you want to do. You can't always know what you want to do. Your feelings evolve. So you might have gone through a life event and then it could have changed everything of how you view life. So an example of this is that I was a swimmer. I grew up as a swimmer. You'd go to swim meets every weekend. It was just expected, like nonstop. And I actually got really unhappy. I went to college. At that point, I just was like, I can't stare at the bottom. And I was getting tired of swim coaches. They would come up with these latest, greatest techniques, but they ended up not being the latest, greatest techniques. It was just, you know, whatever kind of clout that they had. So I started looking, and I didn't really actually like hanging out with the swim team either. So I started looking for other opportunities to evolve and just kind of get away. And I would always constantly ask people, hey, you want to come salsa dancing with me? And no one, everybody would be like, no, you're crazy. Why are you wanting to do that? That's not what the swimmers do. Swimmers go to parties. And I'd be like, no, let's go salsa dancing. Like, let's try something different. Or who wants to do a triathlon with me? And of course, you know, I kind of was the only one that would go out and do these things. And it kind of gave me this room to evolve because I actually found a new set of people, a new set of ideas to bounce off of. And with salsa dancing, I actually found my husband through there, believe it or not. I would never ever, I was not looking by any means whatsoever, but I would never ever think of salsa dancing as a place to meet somebody. But it just so happened to be the first lesson of a first dance course. And this might even be another podcast in itself of how to actually meet people, that we actually got kind of competitive because salsa dancing is very competitive and it's very technical. So it's very, you have to turn on the beat. And then there's all these different nuances that kind of go on. And then through there, we actually, a mutual friend challenged us to do triathlons. So it just kind of opened up my door to a whole new area that you don't have to go about life because everybody is a swimmer and doesn't want to venture outside the pool, that you have that ability to say, you know what, I am going to venture outside the pool. I'm going to actually grow my land legs and, or maybe salsa legs in this case, and go find something else to do. And from there, it just kind of evolved. So, you know, now when somebody says, well, what's your identity? And I say, well, actually, I like to do many sports. I love to do triathlon. I love to do this. So I kind of think of like, what's that long-term happiness? If you're not happy where you are today, you have that choice to kind of say, what do I want to do? And it's okay if I want to explore for a year. Put that into your goal. That's totally fine. And sometimes that's what I do is I say, hey, I need to explore this year. I need to explore these five areas and really determine where I want to move next. So it's that whole idea of innovating and evolving. So instead of just thinking, oh, this is the next best idea, I want to run for it. It's actually like, no, let's explore it. Let's throw that into that mix of, is that really the right place that I want to be? It's kind of like in school. I think that sometimes they force you down a path when you're not really ready. And I talk to a lot of college students about this and ask them where they want to go in life. And, you know, I think that's a very hard question for an 18-year-old to tell you, oh, I want to do this. Mm-hmm. So I always say to them, I say, hey, what are five interests that you have? And can you go on LinkedIn and ask, like find five people that are maybe in those fields, or if you can't do it, let me help you. And, or if you don't feel comfortable, I should say, let me help you. So what we do is we find five interests. So what's interesting is that the career that they thought that they wanted to go into is not what they actually want to go into. They actually find something completely different. So I'm sure the parents are thinking to me, thank you for increasing one more year onto my child's college plan. But I say, look, I've actually saved you money, because when he's 35 or whenever, when he's deciding that he doesn't like what he's doing, he's actually found long-term happiness. So that extra year of college is really worth their long-term happiness and that goal. And that was something that I wish somebody had told me, is actually like talk to five people in five different careers that you're interested in and start to narrow down that validation of what's actually going to work. If I had done that, I probably would have chosen a more technical degree. But that's okay. I'm making the best of what I have, and I'm actually making it into more of a technical degree than what I actually got. And so now I try and help those college students with that same advice. Like, hey, even though you think you might want to do this, and I love how college just kind of says, oh, like, take a personality test. A personality test is kind of, that's great. I mean, my personality test always came back of, you could be a sanitation engineer and still be happy, which really I was like, why am I paying for this degree if that's what the personality test is telling me? So for me, what I've always tried to do is, like, anytime I want to make a career move, is I say, okay, I'm going to pick five people in five different areas that would most likely be of interest to me. And this also helps with your networking as well, too, because you're asking those probing questions. You're saying, is this the right fit for me? And chances are, this is actually how I've made a couple of my career moves, is people say, hey, you know what, you're asking those right questions, and why don't you give this a shot and try it? And it opens up the door. So like I said, you know, moving away from that swimmer into something else, and not being afraid to take that leap. So that leaves us with question number 9. I know we can all relate to this question, and this is probably going to be the shortest answer question of them all, is what is the most spontaneous thing that you've ever done? So why don't we start with Melissa this time?
Yeah, I would say adventure travel for me. You know, I've gone in a lot of places, and I particularly like wilderness where, you know, it's natural beauty. And so I've been to the South Island, New Zealand, and hiked on a glacier. I've been in Nova Scotia on the tip, northern tip, which is really an isolated area where there's these great towns of people who are unbelievable musicians. I've been on the Swiss Alps, the Grand Canyon. I've gone to the Canadian Rockies, out fishing. The Sierras is absolutely beautiful. And I've been to Scotland, England. So I've gone many places, and I always strive for beauty and kind of wilderness. So what about you, Linda?
Well, I actually think I used to be considered the queen of spontaneity among some of my friends, because I was always the person that they'd say, you know, the great thing about you as a friend is I know I can call you at the last minute and you'll be all set to go wherever it is. So there's lots of things that I've done spontaneously that I couldn't even just pick one, because I kind of prided myself on that. But I do have, I had one recent insight that's changed my view a little bit. I used to have a sign that I hung on my door for forever. It's yellowed and faded and everything else. That was, of course, Carpe Diem. And so my whole thing in life was to, like, relish the moment and seize the moment. But the insight I had recently about spontaneity was that sometimes when, if you just jump in without being mindful, I'm sorry to sound a little bit like a broken record with mindfulness, but without being mindful, but sometimes you can end up being reactive without actually, you know, maybe making the best move. And I discovered that I had a value conflict, because my Carpe Diem value for let's seize life and take it and all of that would sometimes conflict with the hangover, I'd say, because after some of my spontaneity activities, I'd be like, I probably really didn't need to do that. So what I think creates the balance in my life is being spontaneous, but also awake and aware about my spontaneity to make better choices.
So what is the most spontaneous thing that I've ever done? I actually moved to Paris without even visiting. talk about switching the norm up. It was a rare opportunity to get to just jump on a plane and not know where you're going exactly, with just six suitcases and then starting a life. I know it's kind of like this dream. And I know many authors have written about this dream of living in France and in Paris. And sometimes you have that vision in your head and you need to go break it. So that's kind of what my spontaneous is moving to Paris without even visiting or speaking the language and having to just kind of, I almost called myself like a paratrooper, just, you know, landing somewhere new and trying to figure out what you need to do to survive. And then figure out how to thrive from your survival there. So that leaves us with question number 10. And question number 10 is, and this is always a good one because I think we sit through many funerals and we start to get this question in our head, but how would you like to be remembered when you are dead and gone? And I know with elderly parents, this is sometimes a conversation we have with them as well too. So Melissa, why don't we start with you? How would you like to be remembered when you are dead and gone?
Mine's really simple. I guess that I was a good person, that people remind me, you know, that she was a good person. But, you know, I do look at, you know, what people say they regret at the end of their lives, and that they were, you know, not showing their true feelings or their real feelings or expressing their feelings to the people they love, and that they spent too much worrying and not enjoying the moment, and that, you know, they didn't take enough risks. You know what I mean? They didn't follow their passion. So hopefully that, you know, I can do all those things and at the end be, you know, not regret anything. So what about you, Linda?
Well, if you asked me in my 20s and 30s, I probably would have said I would have, you know, really wanted my name to be remembered in some, you know, significant way. But I've seen enough buildings and street signs with people's names on it that I have no idea who the person is or what they did other than somehow contributed to having their name there. So in more recent years, I've really felt that, and because I don't have any children, I've really felt that what I'd like to have in terms of a sort of, you know, memory of my time on the planet is more maybe the lingering effects of actions. That what I do perhaps, has had some ripple effect that, you know, I'm happy to be content and not always appreciating what that effect may be. But I'd like to live my life in a way that, that the actions maybe, you know, spurred some positivity in the world.
All right. Last but not least, here we go. So as a contributor, I know we've talked about that, you know, sand going through life. It's truly making it a better place. So how does that equate? So it's helping others figure out maybe where their place in this world is. So helping them give that validation or be known as a giver instead of a taker. Also, another part is truly being disruptive, but not just following the norm, but being disruptive in a proper etiquette way. So, you know, how do you show that creative side, but not be overly annoying about it, and do it in such a way that it doesn't seem like it's an annoyance, but actually people truly learn to value your contribution. And then creativity, hopefully my videos and podcasts will survive to help my kids and grandkids make sense of their purpose of life. And like my last thought is we are all a piece of something greater. I would like to be able to share with the world to not let fear paralyze you. So if you have always been set in one way, you can still make that change. If you're a swimmer, you can be a salsa dancer too. I think we are all born to give. And I think all too often we get stuck in this holding pattern and listen to those that are around us. And they kind of force us to stay on this normal course of life because they themselves haven't ventured into the deep water. And it's kind of this force that creates this bully effect where we kind of get insecure. And we are more concerned about the people around us and their own agenda that we're afraid to kind of raise our hand and say, hey, I'm going to actually go try this over there. That it's kind of made me have this shift of how do I want to achieve my goals, but how can I help others do it and truly make that contribution to the world? And really, when it comes down to it, it's life is really short. We only have so much time on this planet. That what does it mean to others? And can we move on and truly evolve? And if someone can't value you, who can? And keep trying. Like, there are people out there, and with the growing awareness of many different groups, there are so many groups out there that I'm sure that, and there's millions and billions of people, that I'm sure that there's some people that will value your contributions and can truly harness what you have to give. And I've noticed this in corporate world, like if there's somebody that doesn't get what you do and doesn't even want to try and get what you do, move on. It's not worth your time. Life is too short. If someone's putting you down, it's kind of like in grade school. I say they're not worth your time. Find somebody that will truly value you. And there are so many people out there that want to give you that opportunity. You just have to find them. Sometimes it takes a little fighting to get in to really show that you can give, but find those people that will receive. So with that, I think we've concluded our podcast for today. Thank you for listening. To all of our listeners, definitely let us know what's going on. We love to innovate. So we have a function on our website that allows you to write a comment, and we're always happy to receive them. So with that, thanks, everybody, and until next time.
Well, that brings us to the end of this episode. Thanks for listening to the Innovateology Podcast. We hope we have generated some disruptive ideas and helped unleash that creative side. Please help us keep innovating and leave us a comment or a review on our website. Till next time, don't stop innovating.